a fascinating topic that doesn't always get enough attention is the topic of the Tainus Bukharim and the Siyum that has developed to address the Tainus or together with the Tainus. It's particularly appropriate this year because Klal Yisrael is making a Siyum essentially that day, the day before. Maseches Chulin is one of the longest Masechtas in Shas, as we'll get to know a little better next year, God willing. But Maseches Chulin is finishing with Daf Yomi the day before Erev Pesach, so it's a pretty interesting timing. And maybe that's a good opportunity to talk a little bit about this mysterious Tainus Bechorim. It's also starting Maseches Bechoros on Tainus Bechoros, so that's itself an interesting idea. But the concept of a Tainus on that day is mysterious on a lot of levels. So it's mysterious, first of all, where does it come from? It's mysterious, second of all, how authoritative and binding is it, and on who? And it's also mysterious why it is that it's observed the way it is currently, which is to say it basically isn't. That essentially we have this practice of making a siyum, attending a siyum, and how exactly that is developed is also quite fascinating. So just to say a few words about that subject. So when it comes to the question of where does it come from, so there is a statement in the Maseches Sofrim that simply that makes reference to HaBechorim Misanin on Erev Pesach, that the Bechorim are fasting. Is that the only view in Chazal? Is that the only statement anywhere in Chazal? And is it the only position? That's also not clear. The Yerushalmi in Psachim has a somewhat ambiguous passage where we're told that Rabbi fasted on Erev Pesach, and then the Gemara has discussion, did he do that because he was a Bechor, or did he do that because he was an Istanis and it would be hard for him to be able to eat in the Seder properly if he was eating the day before, and therefore maybe that was the reason. So it's unclear how to read that Gemara. It's unclear exactly what the Maskana is. Is there a conclusion that's going to suggest that there's no inyan for the Bechor to fast if we say that it was for a different reason? So that's subject to a lot of discussion. The Meiri and Maseches Psachim talks about how to interpret that Yerushalmi. It's a back and forth, but in any event, when it gets to Shulchan Aruch, so you find in Shulchan Aruch in Siman Tov Ayin that Bechorim Misanin, that Bechorim do fast on Erev Pesach. So it's interesting, as with anything, there is some ambiguity as to how to read that line. There are those who read the Shulchan Aruch to mean that you shouldn't think it's just something people did, that it's just a practice. It's a chiyuv, because if it was not a chiyuv, it would have said something like Nohagul Hisanos or some less authoritative lashon. While there are others who read it the exact opposite and say that if it was really a chiyuv, so the language would have been that Chayovim Hisanos. But by saying HaBechorim Misanin, it's to suggest that it's something that happens, it's something that people do, but not necessarily that there is a Chiyuv Badavar. So there is some ambiguity as to just how obligatory it is, but we can safely say it's a thing. How much of a thing is it? Good question. But clearly it's made it into Shulchan Aruch. The Torah also quoted the Maseches Sofrim. So it clearly exists on some level. And in fact, the Shulchan Aruch records that, this is probably a little known fact, that there are those who say that the female firstborns should also be fasting, that it's not just males, this is an equal opportunity fast. And we'll see, this comes up in about three ways. We'll see that there are egalitarian approaches to the fast, that it's not just the firstborn males, but the firstborn females also. But the Rama adds that that's not our minhag. So that's why you maybe don't hear about this so much. But the Rama says our minhag is that it's only the firstborn males. But it is also egalitarian in a few other ways, because it's a Bechor min ha'av and Bechor min ha'im. That's what the Shulchan Aruch writes. And that there also is a practice to fast on behalf of a child who's too young. if you have a bechor in the household and the bechor is too young to fast, that the father fasts on behalf of the child, and that theoretically could be the mother also. So we have the women being brought in here in at least three possible ways, and if we don't necessarily accept them all, but that it could be that firstborn females fast, that we're talking about a firstborn either from the father or the mother, and that a parent fasting on behalf of a child could be either the father or the mother. So what's the purpose of this fast? So when the Torah quotes from the Maseches Ofrim, it says the Zecher L'Nes, of the salvation of the firstborn during the time of Makkos Becharos. But one could ask, what kind of a Zecher L'Nes is that? So Becky Yosef writes, it's like a Pirsumei Nisa, but it's a very unusual type of Pirsum that we fast in order to be Mefarsim something happy. It's hard to understand why that's an effective method or a usual method of doing this. In fact, there are some who suggest, I think the Menchas Yitzchak quotes in a tshuva and a few others talk about, that there are some sources that wanted to suggest the whole thing is a typo, that there's a missing letter here, and that we dropped a gimel somewhere, and then it should say, HaBechorim Mis'angim, that the Bechorim have oneg on the Erev Pesach to celebrate their salvation. That would clearly affect all of the other sources in a very significant way, but that doesn't seem to be such a strongly held position. And we assume that there's no missing gimel, and that the source indicates that the Bechorim are fasting, which is an unusual way, you would think, to mark an occasion of a Yeshua. So the Zichron Yehuda is quoted in a number of Svarim as having raised that objection. And therefore, the suggestion that he has and has developed in later Svarim also is that maybe this is a Zecher for the fast of the Bechorim, that at that time, the Bechorim who were of Klal Yisrael, so they fasted in order to make sure that they would be spared the Makkah. And that even though, well, that was the deal, that the Makkah was for the Egyptians and not for the Jews, but there's always a concern, like the Gemara in Bracha says, Shema Yigrom HaChet, that Yaakov Avinu had, even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu told him he'd be safe in the encounter with Esav, still he's worried, maybe I did something wrong, maybe I don't have the schus anymore, so we always want to make sure that we're on target. So there's a tradition that the Bechorim fasted. Rabbeinu Yonah in the first Parak of Brachos talks about this. So maybe we are fasting in order to evoke that original fast, in order to recreate that original fast. In which sense, it would seem to be that it's comparable to Tainus Esther. I think we spoke about this a little bit in Tainus Esther, that maybe the idea is to not necessarily express sorrow through the fast, but to recreate the original experience that was successful, and maybe on Erev Pesach we want to do that also. Hi.
Would those be the only two instances where that would be?
I don't know. I always be afraid to say anything is only. Although we'll probably say that a couple times in the next few minutes, but it seems like the first two that would come to mind, maybe the last two. We'll see, but it's an interesting application. Hi.
Why would we want to recreate an experience that was successful when this isn't it's not a threat? Per se.
Well, maybe that's something that's a part of the Pearson. We want to show how we were able to accomplish that, and I think there's more to it also, which eventually we'll get to after throwing in some other details, but I think that's one step along the way. Hi.
I figure I'll be sure it'll be
a question. Okay, well, we'll cover some more, and hopefully it'll become clear. But to say that this is somewhat of a reenactment, so that could explain a few other things, because there are some who ask, you know, if we're just trying to be Makir Tov, so what is the point of saying that it should be limited to contemporary firstborns? The idea of firstborns of this generation, if we're going to limit it, so why limit it to them? There's no particular correlation between anybody who's a firstborn in this generation to the firstborns who were threatened and who were saved in the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim. They're not the descendants of those firstborns. So why should they be the ones to have this extra obligation more than the rest of Klal Yisrael. So if we want to say it's a reenactment, so then that makes more sense. We're acting as if it were happening today. If the threat were today, who would be the ones who would be responding? Who would be the ones who would be fasting? So it would be the firstborns of today. Hi.
It sounds a little bit less like a reenactment, more like a zikr, which kind of stems from the rest of the Pesach.
Okay, so I don't know if there's a fundamental difference between the two for this purpose. That we are kind of staging it, so to speak, in order that it should be a zecher, which could also explain a few other things. There's a discussion in Achronim, what if somebody converts to Judaism? So he was a firstborn as a non-Jew, and now he is became Jewish afterwards, so should he fast also? So presumably within that context it makes a little more sense. Also, the idea that we mentioned of a parent fasting on behalf of a child. So normally, if something is a personal chiyuv, so we don't have a notion that if someone is not old enough to fulfill that chiyuv, that the parent does it on their behalf. They're simply pater. And we have the idea of chinuch, that the parent is training a younger child to do something. But if the child is not in the parsha of doing it themselves on any level, so we don't normally obligate the parent to do it. But if you look at it this way, if you look at it like what would happen if there were a chalila such a threat today on the firstborns of a family, so then somebody in the family would be fasting. So either it's the person himself or it's the parent, and you could perhaps understand that a little bit more. There are other theories as to what the Tainus is about. I think I saw in the name of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach a whole different approach, that really the Bechor was supposed to be doing the Avoda. And that changed at the Chet HaEgel, and it moved over to the Kohanim. So Erev Pesach, the time of the Korban Pesach, so there is a Chalishas Adas on behalf of the firstborn to recognize that they are left out because of what happened. So maybe there is a tainus in order to address that feeling that the firstborns have. So another suggestion, more elaborately laid out in a contemporary sefer called Minchas Aaron, where he noted that the Bechor of the Jewish people, who were at that time designated for the Avodah, time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, so they were staying at home and they were focused on that. So that idea of staying out of trouble, so to speak, that's what we're reenacting, that the contemporary Bechor is going to reenact that by fasting on Erev Pesach. And this multiplicity of explanations also goes to the question of why it is that we say Bechor Min Ha'av and Bechor Min Ha'im, because it seems like there are a combination of different factors here as to what this is really about. And some point out that a Bechor Min Ha'av is the Bechor L'Nachla, and a Bechor Min Ha'im is the Bechor for Kedusha, for Pidgin Abed. So somehow they all come together here as possible reasons for what's going on. So that's how we have this development that it's a Bechor from either side. It's a longer discussion. You can look in those farm who will talk about it at greater length. So in any event, it seems like we have some tradition of a fast. Again, it's a little mysterious as to what exactly it's based on, and it's a little mysterious as to just how obligatory and just how binding it is, together with a few extra levels of mystery as to just who it is who is subject to this fast. And we know that we have developed a practice today that we don't really find the fast observed too often, because the practice has emerged that there is a siyum that will take place on Erev Pesach, and many siyumim all across the world will take place on Erev Pesach, and especially this year, so many people finishing chulam the day before. So that practice seems to exempt everyone from the fast. So is that actually true? So this was certainly a debate. There is a long literature about this on a couple of levels. There is a discussion of whether a bris milah should exempt people from fasting, or should it exempt attendees of the bris from fasting? So that was one debate. There were those who were not so excited about that. You know, Rabbi Yehuda has a well-known shuva.
Would a bris also be mechayev the father to fast on the flip side?
You mean if it's a bechor?
Yeah.
Yes, that's an interesting question. There's also a discussion. He was born now. Let's say he was born That gets into a lot of interesting complications. But that question aside, but the issue of whether a bris should pater the attendees, so that was a discussion. There were those who weren't so excited about that. And the Rebbe Yehuda was particularly upset about the phenomenon in his day. There were all kinds of interesting things that took place in Prague in his day. You can see from the tshuvas. So one of the things he was very upset about was apparently there were people who, if they had a bris that was already pushed off for something, was already in Shalom Bizmana, so they figure, okay, once we're pushing it off, let's push it a few months ahead, a few months down to Erev Pesach, so we don't have to fast. You see how committed they were to eating on Erev Pesach. So they would push the bris off till then, and the Rebbe Yehuda was extremely opposed to that, and he said, this is a terrible thing, and if people keep doing this, they'll have to ban even bris bizmana on Erev Pesach, because people should understand that this is completely unacceptable practice. But let's say bris bizmana does happen on Pesach, so that was a discussion as to whether that should pater people who were there from fasting. But you might think, okay, so a bris bizmana, it has to be that day, so fine, that's totally legit. But what about a siyum? A siyum mesachta, so that's a sudas mitzvah that we know from the Gemara Mesachas Shabbos, and Daf Kuf Yud Ches and Beis, Kuf Yud Tes, where the Gemara talks about making a Yom Tovah LeRabbanan when there was a Shur Rebbe LeRabbanan who would finish a mesachta. And the Marshal, in our Masechta and Bava Kamma, in a few places in the Yom Shel Shlomo, so he makes the point that there is a Sudas Mitzvah status to a Siyum Masechta. So then the question came up, so can a Siyum Masechta be enough to pater from the fast? That would be one Chiddush, because it's already a bigger Chiddush than a Bris, because the Bris is Mano Kavua aspect is there. Siyum isn't inherently tied into that day. And then the bigger question beyond that, perhaps, was should it just be the Masaimim, or could it include people who didn't actually finish the Masechta? So this was a big discussion as well. There were many Achronim who were very opposed to the idea of allowing the Masaim to invite other people to come. If he wants to eat at his Siyum, that's one thing, but to make it a party for other people, many poskim were not so excited about that. And Rebbe Yehuda, again, through his Talmud, Blazer Fleckles, in his Tshuva Me'ave, quotes his Rabbi Rebbe Yehuda as being opposed to this, and Kiva Eger was also opposed to this. A number of other achronim, they thought that it's not appropriate to bring other people into it. But nonetheless, our minig clearly has developed that we do this. And not only do we rely on a siyum, but we also rely on the ability to invite people who are not the Masaimim themselves, people who didn't necessarily do the learning, but they are able to join in the party. That's clearly the contemporary practice. And that is the practice is acknowledged by both Mishneh Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan. Mishneh Berurah writes this in Siman Tefayin over there, that that's what people do nowadays, that they have a siyum and other people are invited and they gather around the Masayim as he finishes the Masechta, and then they share in his Suda. And the Aruch HaShulchan writes this also, that that's clearly the minhag, even though he's a little more surprised by it, he's a little more baffled by how this developed, that we're able to allow ourselves to get out of the fast with such a weak smach, and he assumes it's because of weakness. This is that nowadays, that because we are weak, that must be how we've developed this attitude of leniency towards this practice, because says Svarawise doesn't think it makes so much sense. Again, he acknowledges that that is what we do, but he finds it difficult to justify. So the idea that it's connected to some type of weakness, we should emphasize that there are a couple of counterbalancing factors here before your question, that first of all, fasting on Erev Yontif is already somewhat shaky, and it's not just Erev Yontif, it is Yontif. The 14th of Nisan is its own Yontif. The holiday that we have that we have a Seder and we eat matzah and we drink four cups of wine. So in the Torah, that's called Chag HaMatzos. Chag HaPesach is actually the 14th of Nisan, the day before. When we bring the Korban Pesach, that's its own Yom Tov, has an Issur Melacha, has its own rules. So the idea of Chag HaPesach as a Yom Tov is another reason why it's surprising that we should allow fasting on that day. So it's a little tricky from that perspective, from a halachic perspective, how do we square having a fast on that day? And also, there are challenges from other directions. So there are many people who would find it hard to go from fasting to a lavish meal like the Seder, that to not eat all day, and then to break the fast on something so elaborate. Many people have a hard time doing that, and therefore it could lead to interfering with the major Doraisa mitzvos that are associated with the Seder. So the whole idea of eating on Erev Pesach is a very tricky balance, because we know the Mishnah says in Erev Pesachim that you shouldn't really eat too much on Erev Pesach as it gets closer to dark, to preserve the appetite. And we mentioned before the Yerushalmi about Rebbe not eating at all because he didn't think he'd be able to handle the Seder as well. But there's also the possibility of going too far in the other direction, that if you're fasting absolutely on Erev Pesach, that could also make it very difficult to fulfill the mitzvot at the Seder properly. So that also seems to be a part of the mix, that there is this concern that there are various challenges to being able to really pull off a normal fast on that day, and that we have more openness perhaps to being makel because of some of those considerations. So you had a question before?
Yeah, so one question I had was, can the before eat after the
so yeah, I want to get to that.
And then the other question was, well, now that we brought up the idea of no malacha on Erev Pesach, I mean, presumably people do some sort of malacha.
Yeah, a whole other subject. So let's, that's a tangent. Let's just try to finish this first in the time that we have. But as far as this is concerned, so the siyum, what exactly qualifies the siyum is also a discussion. That, first of all, what about the fact that often the siyum is accelerated or slowed down in order to hit Erev Pesach? Is that something that's acceptable? So, you know, there you find again kind of mixed attitudes. We insist that if we're going to rely on the Siyum, it's got to be 100% legit without any tweaking. Or is it something that we're willing to accept a little bit of time manipulation? And also, what qualifies? So the question of what counts as a masechta. So we normally assume nowadays that it has to be a masechta of Gemara or a Seder of Mishnayos. So one could ask, why don't we say that a masechta of Mishnayos is enough, considering the fact that if there's a reference to a siyum in the Gemara, so a siyum at that time would have to mean just a Seder Mishnayos. They didn't have Gemara, they were the Gemara. So they didn't learn the Dapim, they didn't have those pages. So when they learned the Masechta, it meant the Masechta's Mishnayos. So why can't we also make a Siyum on Mishnayos? So there are two approaches to that. It's a nice discussion about this in the Sefer Oros HaPesach, Rabbi Shlomo Werman, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha. He focuses a lot on these questions. But there are at least two approaches. One approach is to say that the idea of a siyum and the simcha that comes with finishing something, that means that you finish whatever is perceived as that endeavor. So once upon a time, to learn Bava Kamma would have meant to learn all the Mishnayos in Bava Kamma. But today, to learn Bava Kamma means to learn all the Gemaras in Bava Kamma. And that approach could also address, and sometimes people ask, that there are some masechtas when we know we're missing some lines, that they were taken out. So would you say it's impossible to make a siyum on that masechta because you can't finish it? So we don't assume like that. We assume that whatever exists nowadays as our perception of that masechta, so then the simcha shel mitzvah of finishing, that happens when you finish that content. Others have pointed out that it's true that they didn't have a written down Gemara in the time of the Amoraim, but they were the Gemara. So their discussions, they were on the level that would be comparable to what we have when we actually learn the Gemaras, our written down records of their discussions. So they were having those discussions, so therefore they were learning the Masechta on that level. So that's why, in order to try to match what they were describing, we have to learn the actual Gemaras. It could be there are other ways to get to that. So B'shas Tzedchak, there are some who say that if you learn a Masechta Mishnayos, but you learn it with a Bar Tanura, and you learn it with a Tosfos Yontif, you learn it with various Sfarim that bring down the conclusions of the Gemara and the points of the Gemara, or you're such a baki that when you learn the Mishnayos, it brings to mind all the discussions in the Gemara that you're already familiar with from before, so you don't need to go through the actual words. There are those who say B'shas Tzedchak that that would also be acceptable. What seems to emerge is that it should be a big deal. It should be whatever it takes to really feel like this is a simcha. So if it's going to be a Seder of Mishnayos, so it should be a thoroughly done Seder of Mishnayos, either with a major Mefarshim or with a greater level of involvement than would normally be. And theoretically, it could be a Sefer of Tanakh also. Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about this. He says, theoretically, it could be a Sefer of Tanakh if it was a serious project. If you went through it with Mefarshim and you really undertook a big endeavor to try to learn a Sefer of Tanakh very seriously, that could theoretically be a Siyum also. So what really emerges from the Svarim in terms of these questions is it's got to be legit on some front. So either it's a major learning project so that you can then tweak the timing a little bit to get into the right day, or if you're doing it specifically for Erev Pesach, so then it's got to be more significant than just a Masechta of Mishnayos. It's got to be something that really represents some level of simcha and actual effort in order to be something to celebrate.
What about Masechta's
Talmud? So Masechta's Talmud is a Masechta. So, you know, so yeah. People learn Horius because they fool themselves into thinking it must be easy. Okay, it's only 12 blat, 13 blat, so therefore I can get this one done quickly. They think they can get that done during the 9 days. They don't realize that once you start, it's a much harder Masechta than people think. So there's always some kind of a trade-off that's involved. Somebody asked me that he's learning Daf Yomi, so he's finishing Chulin right before, but he missed one Daf, and he doesn't remember which Daf he missed. So, you know, it's interesting. It's a question of Bittel Barov, you know, it's a Sugi and Chulin. But, you know, presumably, there is a... He's learning with Daf Yomi, so there's somebody in the Chabura who probably finished that Daf that he's missing. So, you know, it's probably what to rely on from that perspective. But in any event, there is a lot of discussion as to what exactly qualifies in order to count as a Siyum for this purpose. And we talk about the process here. So, okay, so we're also makel to allow other people to join in the Siyum, and that's indeed what happens. Pashtus joining in the Siyum means being there as part of the meal. There is a question sometimes comes up, what if somebody is traveling that day? People are often traveling that day, because let's say if they're going somewhere for Pesach, so they might be flying on Erev Pesach, they might be driving long distances on Erev Pesach, and sometimes they're not able to be present at a Siyum. So the question comes up, can they listen in on a phone call or on the radio? It's a very hard misvara to understand that, because setting aside the question of, let's say, Megillah or Havdalah, whether you can be Yotze listening on the radio or on the telephone, so there, okay, it's a question of whether that counts as the actual voice. But here, you would think that's not really the issue, because it's not about hearing words specifically. It's really about being a part of the Suda. So, as funny as it sounds, it really would work better the opposite way. Now, you would think that if a person misses the actual siyum but gets there to partake of the suda, that's actually better than the other way around, presumably, because then you are partaking of the celebration. It's not necessarily so much an inyan to hear the actual words. Certainly better to hear the actual words. You have some chelik in the limud, so we can justify it a little better. But if we can only do one without the other, it almost makes more sense to say it's better to be there at the meal than it is to hear the siyum without being at the meal, because the issue really is that he's inviting everybody to join in this celebration and to partake of the Suda's mitzvah. So logically, it's very, very difficult to see how listening over the phone can work. Nonetheless, there were those who allowed this. I saw that my friend Rabbi Usher Bush, in his recent Sefer Shol B'Shlomo, has a discussion about this, where he works off the perspective that it doesn't make so much sense to say that listening on a phone or radio should really accomplish anything as far as this is concerned. But again, there's a general attitude of kula that we bring towards this, and we don't want that kula to mean that we just dispense with the fast without anything, or that, you know, there's no effort for a siyum whatsoever. So it seems that the minig has developed that we insist on at least some minimal connection to a siyum in order to address it, and maybe that's how you get to a very lenient approach to what exactly constitutes that kind of involvement. Again, logically speaking, that starts to really cross out of the boundaries of what seems to be connected here. But nonetheless, there were those who were makel about that. So perhaps we could put a little bit more of a positive spin on this whole question. Question about that?
Is there a maximum time frame that can exist between finishing the masechta or the project and making the siyum?
That's also a discussion. It doesn't sound like there necessarily is. You know, it must have some clear connection. But there, you know, it gets to this question of whether pushing it off and accelerating it or the other way, whether that's legitimate or not. There are those who point out that there are rayas from Tanakh, maybe even, and certainly from Shas, that the celebration of such a thing can be somewhat portable and can be flexible. So it doesn't sound like it necessarily. But in any event, so maybe we could put a little bit more of a positive spin on this, and this is to also address the question that Jed brought up before. So two questions here. One question is why it is that our practice has evolved to allow dealing with the fast or not fasting through a siyum, and we don't have that practice on other fast days. So we don't have that practice on Tisha B'Av, when there's an Isser Talmud Torah anyway. That's actually relevant, because there are also sometimes people are, Rahman al-Islam could be an Avelis on Erev Pesach, and that would very possibly preclude them. If they're a Bechor, they very possibly need to fast, because they don't have the option of partaking in a siyum under their circumstances. But for the most part, we don't have this happening with anything else that we allow a siyum to excuse us from the obligations of the day. And the one exception to that is the 9 days, where a similarly controversial practice has evolved to allow a siyum to be used to permit meat and wine during the 9 days, when we otherwise have a practice not to eat meat and wine. In fact, I mentioned a sefer of Tanakh, Rabbi Werman also quotes that the Shulam Likutna, I believe, used to eat meat on Motzai Tisha B'Av. You know, our practice is to keep the Hanhagas of the 9 days until the next morning, until Chatzos the next day, if it's not a Nidche, and to not eat meat and drink wine on Motzai Tisha B'Av. But he would eat meat and drink wine on Motzai Tisha B'Av because of the siyum that he made on Sefer Eicha. So that's an interesting application of different factors here. But in any event, so we only have this heter, so to speak, of a siyum as a heter for other things. We only have that on Erev Pesach and during the 9 days. And separating the two of them in this case, so they're linked in that way, but they're different, that when it comes to the 9 days, so if you make a siyum, so you have meat and wine during that meal, but after that meal, so then everything goes back to the way it was. So then the prohibitions revert to being in practice. While on Erev Pesach, the assumption is that once the Bechor eats at this Suda, so then he's finished with the fast completely. He's allowed to eat the rest of the day. And that's a surprising position. Doesn't seem to be what we find elsewhere. Like we said, it's not what we find by the 9 days. And normally you'd assume that if it's a regular fast day, if somebody eats for whatever reason on a regular fast day, so then the rest of the day he's supposed to keep fasting. We don't assume that if you ate once, then it's over. But then the rest of the day you keep fasting. So why should this tinus be different? The Kadosh Lover has a tshuva about this, where he suggests that it has to do with the unique nature of the fast, that it's not really a fast of sadness, but it's some kind of a zecher or a reenactment. So normally, on, let's say, Sarah Batavis, so you have two aspects. You have the inyan of it being a complete fast day, and you have it every moment, and iser to eat. And when it comes to Tainis Bechorim, apparently it's different. Apparently there's just the inyan of it being seen as a fast day, but there's no specific iser at every moment to eat. So once we address the fast day part, so then if that's no longer in effect, so then there isn't anything left to prohibit eating during the remaining hours of the day. But again, maybe we could take a slightly different approach and to consider in a more positive sense, so why is it that we embrace the concept of the siyum both during the 9 days and on Erev Pesach, and then after that, why they diverge in terms of this question of do we go back to normal after the meal is over? So to look to the 9 days for a second, I think there is maybe a more positive approach to take to the notion of making a siyum, sometimes looked on very negatively by many poskim and many svarim, had great hesitancy about the practice of making a siyum during the 9 days to be matir basav yayin. Yet there is a minig among Klal Yisrael and many of Klal Yisrael to be more positive about this. I think it's possible to suggest that the reason we are more open to it is because we don't really perceive it as a distraction from the day. If one were to find some way to eat on Asar B'Teves or on Shavasu B'Talmas, so then that would be a distraction from the theme of the day. But the idea of not eating meat and not drinking wine during the 9 days, so what's that? What's that meant to accomplish? So it's not really an expression of Avelus. A person is an Avelus, he's allowed, this person is in Shiva, is allowed to eat meat and drink wine. But the idea is that it's a recognition of what we're missing in the Churban, that when the Beis HaMikdash was Kayim, so meat and wine were brought on the Mizbech for holy purposes. And the Gemara says in Baba Basra that initially they thought that if there's no Beis HaMikdash, so we shouldn't allow meat and wine ever. But that was something that the Tzibur couldn't handle. So our practice, at least in Ashkenazim and Sfardim have different versions of this, but our practice has emerged that during the time when we feel the Churban most acutely, during the 9 days, so then at least we try to be on that level where we abstain from meat and wine in recognition of the fact that we don't have meat and wine being brought on the Mizbeach. So if that's the case, maybe when you eat at a Sudas Mitzvah during the 9 days, that's not necessarily a distraction from the 9 days, that's a kiyum of the 9 days. We're saying that we wish we were in the time when we could use our meat and wine for holy purposes, when it could be brought towards Kedusha, it could be brought in the Mizbeach. And having meat and wine in a Sudas Mitzvah is a way of saying in a more positive sense that this is what we aspire to, that that would be the context in which we can eat meat and drink wine. So maybe it's not that it's a way of pretending it's not the 9 days for an hour, it's a way of actually focusing on the theme of the 9 days in a more positive sense, that we should have a return of Basar Shal Mitzvah, of Yayin Shal Mitzvah. That's what we're looking forward to. So on Tainis Bechorim also, we see that it's not about that we're supposed to be miserable. And if we were to eat, then we'd be distracting ourselves from our misery. We'd be taking ourselves out of the day. it's perhaps a very different idea. The idea, in addition to all the other questions of whether it's really appropriate to be fasting on the 14th of Nisan, but it's also that we are commemorating how the firstborn of Egypt were struck and the firstborn of the Jewish people were spared. And the question is, why should they have been spared? We know that we have many references throughout Chazal that the Jews in Egypt were not necessarily on so much of a greater level than the Jews, than the Mitzrim rather, were not necessarily more deserving personally, and you find that coming up a lot. And the whole chap is that we had to start distinguishing ourselves, we had to start making ourselves worthy. So one way to do that is tshuva, is fasting. That's one way to turn over a new leaf. Another way is to literally turn over a new leaf, turn over a new daf, to be involved in learning, to fully embrace the mission that Klal Yisrael was going to be charged with at that point, this whole process of Yetzias Mitzrayim and Kabbalah Satorah. So one could argue that that itself is really a fulfillment of what it is that we are trying to highlight on Erev Pesach. So we are trying to call attention to what it is that allowed us, and allowed the firstborn, and of course the loss of the firstborn, Chalila, is not just a loss for them, it's a loss for all the families, a loss for everybody. So to create a greater communal involvement in what the Zecher is also a kiyum, really, in the day, because it would seem like it shouldn't really just be the firstborn who should be thinking about this, it should be all of Klal Yisrael. So the idea that we've developed a hanhaga that we embrace learning and celebrating learning and making a statement about the values of learning and the fact that this is what we embrace, this is what we endorse, this is what makes us happy, the Pekudi Hashem Yishar and Masam Chilev, and that we do that on a communal level and we invite everyone else to celebrate this also. This is what distinguishes us from the Mitzrim at that time. This is what made us worthy, the potential to start going down in that path, and perhaps that's why the practice has developed among Klal Yisrael to use that kind of approach for Erev Pesach, and maybe that is indeed a fulfillment of the message that we're trying to emphasize. And therefore this year, having so many people finishing a Masechta on that week or the day before that, a beautiful evolution of learning programs such as Daf Yomi and so many other endeavors that have been undertaken in the past few generations to allow the flourishing of Talmud Torah, not only on the highest levels, but through communal engagement and through a tzibur, through a Klal Yisrael kind of way, is really a phenomenal thing, and it's something that we here in Yeshiva appreciate particularly, and to be able to celebrate that at this time, as we go into Pesach, as we go into our Gula, I think it's a very powerful message. And we should be zocha to be able to fully internalize what that represents and to bring that to our Seder experience. So just to quickly, as we spoke about, we mentioned the fact that there is a mysterious history to the Tainus of Erev Pesach, somewhat ambiguous sources, the Masach HaSofrim and the Yerushalmi, and even the statement in the Shulchan Aruch, HaBachorim Misanin, is subject to some debate. Is that a hanhaga? Is that a chiyuv? Is it a chiyuv on both males and females? Is it a chiyuv on a bachor min ha'av min ha'em, as the Shulchan Aruch says it is? The idea of parents taking on behalf of younger children, all of that is very unusual. And talked about the question of what exactly we're accomplishing. It sounds like it's some kind of a Zecher l'Neis, which is a very strange way to commemorate the Neis, so maybe it's more of kind of an enactment of what happened then. Similar on some level to what we said about Tainus Esther. But we talked about a few other explanations, Rav Shlomo Zalman and the Menuchas Aaron and otherwise. Then we talked about the whole historical evolution of whether there were any ways when one wouldn't have to fast. Would a bris work? Would attending a bris work? Would a siyum work? Would attending a siyum work? It was extensive machlokas. But once we get to Mishnah Berurah and the Aruch HaShulchan, there is acknowledgement that this is the minig, even if it's a minig because of weakness, as the Aruch HaShulchan. suggests. We mentioned a few other complicating factors to having a tinnitus on that day, but nonetheless, that's what has emerged. And then we talked about what qualifies as learning, whether it's a Masechta of Gemara, a Seder of Mishnayos, could it possibly be a Masechta of Mishnayos? We talked about various approaches to that, and the idea of others joining into the meal. Talked about the question of one is not physically able to be there, how it's hard to understand how listening over the phone should work unless it's just an expression of a general attitude of kula. What's a little bit more compelling is that to be at the Suda without the Siyum is in a sense more effective than to be at the, to hear the Siyum without the Suda. But in any event, that's a discussion of itself. And then we talked about the fact that the Bechor then eats for the rest of the day, which is at odds with the practice of every other fast day if one were to eat in the middle of a fast day. And it's also at odds with the practice of the 9 days, where Siyum is Matur Basav Yayin, but then after that we go back to the Isur Basav Yayin for the rest of the day and the rest of the week, if that's the case. So we talked about the differences between the two, and we suggested that maybe we could link the two more positively and say that when it comes to both of these, the Siyum is an expression of the values of the day and not a distraction. If one were to make a Siyum on Asar B'Teves and to eat on that day, that would be a distraction from the sad atmosphere of Asar B'Teves. But when it comes to the 9 days, so the 9 days, meat and wine specifically, is about our Sheifa for the Kedusha of meat and wine of the Beis HaMikdash. So to be able to eat in a Suz Mitzvah is a focus on the theme of the day rather than a distraction, but it only works for that meal. After that meal is over, after it's not a Seder Mitzvah anymore, so then it doesn't have any carryover beyond that. But when it comes to Erev Pesach, there's a similar but different approach, that perhaps the Siyum is also a keem of the day, if the whole point is to focus on what allowed the firstborn of the Jewish people to survive this Makkah, if the Jews and the Egyptians until then had not been that different. So it was the embracing of the new role of Klal Yisrael that allowed them to survive. So that starts with tshuva, it starts with the tainish, but also perhaps even more actively, the involvement in Talmud Torah is itself the kiyum of the day, and inviting others to partake in the Talmud Torah, or at least to partake in the recognition of the chashivas of Talmud Torah, and the fact that that is the central value, that essentially is what takes us from Galus to Geula. That's what brings us to being worthy of the Pesach experience, and that's perhaps very valuable for us as we anticipate our Starim, to be able to have an Erev Pesach that has such a focus. Okay, we will stop here. I wish everyone a wonderful day. And these are one of the issues. Okay, so again, tomorrow